everybody. This is Lecture 11. As planned, we're a little bit behind schedule, but not too much. The plan is to finish off Chapter 7 today. There's just a little bit left to do, an important bit, but we can finish that off and then move on to talk about general relativity in the second half of this lecture and in the remaining four lectures of this sub-course. I'll first mention, I see that there are questions appearing on the Padlet. That's good. So one appeared this morning, answered that. I take the point about handwriting, but the goal is to in a sense, show the maths on the scribbles rather than have beautiful notes. I have in the past put up scanned versions of those scribbles, but the folk last year, the staff student later on committee said, oh, there's too much stuff in the middle, oh my God. And so I said not to do that. But if folk would have a different opinion this year, I can scan those if that would be useful or if that sort of not really necessary. No one feels strongly about that. Mail me. So where we are now is getting on toward, well, finishing off chapter 6 and 7 on kinematics and dynamics and moving on. Any questions, either organisational or where we got to last time? Yes?
Up to what point would be examinable?
Right. I haven't really thought about that yet. I've only just finished marking assignment one,
right,
like at 4 o'clock last night. So I haven't got as far as that. But I think in previous years I have I've only gone as far as chapter six and seven. So there's stuff for today. So the class test is still, that's at the end of November?
23rd.
23rd, right. Oh, that deadline soon. Okay, I have to think about that. I will make a ruling about that shortly and announce it when at some point. But I think it will basically be chapter six up to the stuff today. But there's not possibly. I'll see what a sensible thing to say is. But good question. Thank you. Anything else there? Okay. Let us get going. I will get rid of that. And chapter 7 next, okay, where we had got to, I think, was talking about this. And this collision, where if you recall, we're looking at a simplified collision here of two, of relativistic putty, two things which come in with four momenta, whatever they are, and merge into one outgoing object with appropriate four momenta. And we simplify things by saying that this is all going to happen along the x-axis. So we're going to ignore the y and z components will be zero, and these things will be colliding head-on into some sort of outgoing single particle. And what we deduced last time from the conservation of momentum, which I said was the other physical statement that I was making in these lectures, was this table, where the incoming velocity, the sort of target particle is stationary, the incoming particle is at a nice convenient 15/17 of the speed of light, and we worked all the other numbers using the expressions we have accumulated so far. And the point is, as I was just saying at the very end last time, the momenta are conserved. So that you add up the incoming momenta component by component, and you get the outgoing energy momentum of the particle. That allows you to deduce the velocities of the outgoing particle, because it's just it ends up being just the x component divided by the zero component. You'll see the notes for details. And the masses of the incoming particles are as expected. So that if we obtain the mass, respecting the equation that e squared equals p squared plus m squared, which was one of the things we deduced last time, we discover that the mass the mass by that formula is 8, which is what we put into this, if you recall. And that oddly enough, the masses don't add up. So the energy momenta add up component by component, but the mass, it doesn't add up. And I introduced the terms that the mass, that the energy momentum is conserved, meaning it's the same before and after a collision. We will discover that things which are the same in different frames, such as the length of the energy momentum vector, are frame independent. Or invariant is another way of putting that. So I'm introducing terminology here. So invariant means the same in all frames. Conserved means both means the same before and after a collision. And constant, such as the speed of light, means it's the same everywhere. That's the full house of invariant and conserved and everything. So that's what we got to last time. Now, that is the so-called lab frame. And this is a particle physics term. It's called the lab frame because you're hitting something which is stationary. And if you have a target of whatever you want and you have an accelerator, then the target is stationary in the lab frame, obviously. That's why it's called the lab frame. There's nothing profound to that. But we can change frames. It's really confusing. So let's do that. Can we see that? Can we see that? No, we can't see that. Let's see if we can get this to the right. Okay. So, by conservation of momentum, we're going to see that the energy momentum of this outgoing particle 3, so P3, is going to be gamma 1 M1 plus gamma 2 M2. Is the T component, and gamma 1 M1 V1 plus gamma 2 M2 V2 is the X component. And remember, the Y and Z components are zero. Here, this gamma 1 is just gamma of the velocity, corresponding to the velocity of the first particle, and so on. So all that I've written down there is the result of energy momentum conservation. Okay, if you've got incoming momenta P1, P2, then the outgoing one is that. But let's change frame now. Let's go to another frame. So look at the same four vector, but in a different frame, a frame which is moving with speed v. So what are the components of this vector, this four vector, in that new frame? That's easy. That's just mechanical. That's just looking at the transformation equation, the matrix expression at the beginning of chapter 6, and we discover that we can find what the zero component of momentum 3 in the prime frame is. We can discover that, whatever it is, and we can look at the one component, the X component, of particle 3 in the primed frame. So this is quite a compact notation here. And that will be gamma V, where that's the speed of the new frame, times P3 1 minus VP3 0. Now I just want to unpack that. I'm not pulling a fast one here. This is just the transformation equation that goes from one frame to another. And so this is one of the lines of that matrix at the beginning of chapter 6. And this looks like the Lorentz transformation equation. That looks like T minus Vx is basically what that is. And notice that's P3(1), not P3 primed. This is where my handwriting is fairly neat, because maths has to be fairly neat, even if you can't necessarily interpret it massively. P3(1) primed is the one component of momentum, 3 in the other frame. Okay, what does that look like with this expression for P3? So we have, this is P3(0), and this is P3(1). Okay, the one component of P3. That is gamma V. P3(1) is gamma 1 M1 V1 plus gamma 2 M2 E2 minus V gamma 1 M1 plus gamma 2 M2. Like that. Job done. Okay, so that's the components of this the same energy momentum tip 4 vector in the other frame of arbitrary v, moving at speed, speed along the x-axis at speed v. But we can pick we can make a sensible choice of what that v is, because if we decide, let's pick the frame in which P3(1) primed is equal to 0. Let's pick the frame in which the outgoing particle has 0 spatial momentum. The frame in which the outgoing particle is at rest. Okay? So that will be not the lab frame, but it'll be the frame in which which is moving just right, so that after the collision, you're moving alongside the outgoing particle. In that frame, this would be 0. And in that frame, that tells us what V is. That V will be we that expression over that expression, and using the velocities that we have chosen in this particular example, that will be So in this particular example, remember the two incoming masses, M1 and M2, are both equal. They're both equal to 8, and so they cancel out. We get gamma 1 V1 plus gamma 2 V2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2, and using the numbers we've chosen, that's equal to 3/5, which matches what we saw before. In this table, that the outgoing particle is moving at speed 3/5. So just to reiterate, what we've done is we've chosen to go to a frame in which is moving at speed 3/5, and in that frame, the outgoing particle is stationary. Okay? And hold on to that thought. In that frame, we can look at what we can calculate what this table is in that frame by transforming these expressions component by component or otherwise. And I won't go through that step by step. There's an exercise which encourages you to do so. And we get an expression like this. And here, so there's a kind of handle turning to get this. But you can go through it, and I heartily encourage you to go through the steps of this, because it's very instructive just to get those mechanics in place. What we see is some different numbers, but there's also a pattern to these. You notice that in this frame, the speed of the outgoing particle is 0. That's by definition. That's because that's how we chose this frame. it means that the speeds of the incoming particles are equal and opposite because they have equal mass. So in this frame, the particles are coming in from opposite directions, merging and just staying there because the momentum is conserved. The energies of the two particles are different. The spatial momenta of the two particles are equal and opposite, but these are still conserved in the collision. So that the energy momentum of the product particle is still the sum of the energy momentum of the two incoming particles. The components are different because this is because although this is the same vector, the same energy momentum vector, it's the same P3. Because you're looking at it in a different frame, the components are different. But the same rules apply. The energy momentum is still conserved. And notice the masses are the same. So the masses, although the components E and P are different, the masses of the incoming particles and the mass of the product particle are as they were before. Of course, because that mass is just the squared length of the energy momentum particle. So it doesn't matter what components, what frame you're picking, the components will change, but they'll change in such a way that this length stays the same. Okay? So that illustrates quite a number of things about the changing of frames and about four vectors. And that seems a bit like sleight of hand, because I haven't gone through each of those calculations. And that's why I encourage you to go through those afterwards, just to reassure yourself there's nothing tricky happening here. Any questions about that? Okay. Particle physicists care about this because there's a lot more. For example, the collisions at CERN. At the collision vertices at the four experiments around the LHC, they are designed so that you have two contra-rotating beams which hit each other head-on. So the lab frame in that context is the same as the center of mass frame, because in order to maximize the energy available for collisions. In a linear accelerator like SLAC, which is just a long straight accelerator which hits a target, the lab frame and the center of momentum frame are not the same. But this is astronomy, not particle physics. So we're not going to go into that too much. Now, did anyone think there's anything odd about this? Well, apart from the obvious things, but there's a key thing that seems very strangely odd about this in the final column. That's right, that's it. So the mass is not conserved. There appears to be more mass afterwards than there was before. So there's more gravity there than there was before. Where does this mass come from? And that is strange. And you can puzzle away at that, but I'll short-circuit it by saying that mass is not the source of gravity. Gravity doesn't come from mass. Gravity comes from energy momentum. So it's the amount of energy momentum that is the source of mass, not the amount of stuff. Okay? And if you imagine this expand that? I've worded this fairly carefully here. Yes. Say you have this box, the two incoming particles, you have this collision, the two incoming particles and the outgoing particle, and you put it in a box. Okay. Afterwards, you've just got this say you're in the centre of momentum frame. Afterwards, you've got this big lump of stuff sitting there, which is probably very hot and so on. There's a lot of gravitating stuff. Before, you seem to have less mass. But the particles were moving very rapidly. In other words, there was lots of oomph there before the collision. So you have two things colliding and then just stopping. You end up with one heavy particle afterwards. Before, you had two lighter particles, but they were moving very rapidly. And so it's that energy momentum that is contributing to the gravitation. So it's not mass that gravitates, but energy momentum. The fact that you have a lot of energy in the box, not all of it in the form of mass, is what gravitates. And we'll come back to that in the other lectures, but that's an important thing to stress and to think about as you walk home. Right, I'm keen to press on. I'm going to... is not mass the source of gravitation, but forward momentum. Okay. Now, I'm going to fairly quickly mention another change of units, but this is much less confusing than natural units. You will have, I'm sure you'll recall. Have you come across the Jansky? Has that been taught? Okay, you know the Jansky, and the Jansky. It sounds exotic unit. But all it is a convenient name for a convenient small number, and a convenient small amount of. Of course, you've been doing a lot of observational astronomy, and it's units of flux per square meter. I think. So it's given a name because it's a convenient small quantity. In the context of particle physics. You have particles moving around all over the place, and there, a convenient unit of energy is the electron volt, which is that number of joules. It's not very many joules, but it's that number of joules. And one electron volt is the amount of energy an electron has once it's been accelerated through one volt. So it's a nice, sensible unit. And I'm not going to say very much more about it other than that it's a convenient unit to use. There's not much more that's exciting to say about that. But if I do refer to it later on, then that's the section to go back and remind you of what I mean. So we'll finish off with a worked example, a very important worked example. About Compton scattering, so-called. So this is, you are familiar with Thomson scattering, I presume. That's why the sky is blue. Electromagnetic wave comes along, accelerates a charged particle, and which re-radiates, and the color changes, and the electromagnetic wave is scattered by different amounts depending on the frequency. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking here is an electron, an incoming photon, which bounces off the electron, scattering it. And this is a quantum mechanical collision. We didn't go into the details, but it's a quantum mechanical collision in which the photon as a particle collides with the electron as a particle, and the two recoil in the same way that you're familiar with from Newtonian physics, but in this case, one of the particles in the collision is a photon. Now, we want to analyse this collision. So we'll set it up with the incoming photon having energy Q1, because it has Planck's constant times an incoming frequency. The outgoing photon we'll call energy Q2, HF2. The outgoing electron will have mass M, and outgoing energy E and momentum P at certain scattering angles. And this is just the figure 7.3. So we have all the dynamical information there. We can write this down component by component and conserve the incoming momentum, energy momentum, through the collision and find out and balance that. What we discover is that the incoming What I'm going to write down is that before, the electron is stationary, so the zero component of the energy momentum is just its mass. And it's not moving. So the x, y, and z components of momentum are zero. Before the momentum of the incoming photon is going to be q1, but it's its energy, and it's moving entirely in the x direction. And so in order for the length, the length squared of this four momentum to be zero, we can deduce that the x component of its energy momentum is going to be the same, because it's moving, and it's all on the x component because it's moving along the x axis. So there, q1 squared minus q1 squared is equal to zero, as a photon four momentum must be. Afterwards, the electron, outgoing electron, has energy E. We've just decided to label that component E. And the components of the spatial momentum are going to be P cos theta and sine cos theta. We're just doing the same thing that you've rehearsed in previous years with conservation of momentum. The only difference here is we've got a fourth component in here. P2 gamma is going to be Q2, the energy of the outgoing photon, and similarly the two x and y components of the spatial momentum, Q2 cos phi, Q2 sine phi. And again, you can see that Q1 squared minus Q2 cos phi squared minus Q2 sine phi squared is going to be equal to zero, as it has been the case for a photon. And we can balance this component by component. M plus Q1 is equal to E plus Q2. Q1 is equal to P cos theta plus Q2 cos phi. 0 is equal to P sine theta plus Q2 sine phi, and so on. And I won't go through if we had a little more time, I would go through the step by step. I won't do that. It's in the notes. The point is that what we're doing here is exactly the same as what you've done in previous years in Newtonian physics. And we add everything up, do a bit of algebra, slightly fiddly algebra, but not hard, and discover that 1 over Q2 minus 1 over Q1 is equal to 1 minus cos phi over m. Or in terms of, if you remember that the q is just the, in terms of the frequency, and thus in terms of the wavelength, so that lambda 2 minus lambda 1 is equal to Planck's constant over m, 1 minus cos phi, the Compton formula. And this is not a Doppler shift, so the outgoing photon has changed its wavelength, it changed its energy, but it's not a Doppler shift, because we're not talking about changes of frames here. There's no Lorentz transformation here. All we're doing here is constant conserving momentum, relativistic momentum. But we can discover a prediction for the change in the photon energy in this case, which is amply verified by experiment. And this is, you can do this in a lab. This process is also important astrophysically. because the process of so-called inverse competence scattering, where you go the other way around, and in black hole accretion disks, a thermal photon can be scattered off a high energy electron. So this is the opposite process, where a photon collides with a relativistic electron and increases its energy, so you get X-ray emission from black hole accretion disks because of the inverse of this process. In a way that a particle physicist would delight at and an astrophysicist would delight at. So I skimmed over a couple of algebraic details, but you can sort those out. So that brings us to basically the end of the special relativity part of this course. We're going to go on to GR in just a moment. But it brings us to the end rather neatly with an application of all this stuff that you've been learning about relativistic trains and so on in a way which is important for particle physics and for astrophysics. There are other a variety of other applications of this the relativistic version of quantum mechanics is relativistic quantum mechanics is what allowed people to discover the idea of the neutrino and so on. Quantum field theory, which modern particle physics is based heavily on, is founded on special relativity. So in the sense that quantum field theory is just quantum mechanics redone with the assumption that the universe is based on is structured around special relativity. So you won't. So in a sense, you might not use special relativity again in a specific. In this is where my special relativity lectures come in. You won't have to calculate the speed of relativistic trains. But in order to understand where relativistic quantum mechanics comes from, in order to understand where quantum field theory comes from, you will have to be thinking in a special relativistic world. And the interesting thing, is that what we've covered here is basically all the special relativity there is. There isn't sort of advanced special relativity. Relativity in the special case of no acceleration is sort of done. Okay. The more general case of relativity with acceleration or relativity with gravitation is what general relativity is. That's what the general is in general relativity. And we're going to go and talk about that now in a moment. But there's not more of it as such. And I hope that you have, at the beginning of, in lecture one, I said that there wasn't a lot of hard maths in this course, in the sense that what the word was addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and square roots. And okay, we've got four vectors as a sort of extension to three vectors, and that's a bit of maths, but that's basically all there is. I hope you realize that's true, what I said. But also, I think you'll also congratulate yourself having got here, because although the mathematical bricks mortar that you're using are quite simple, the way that you've had to put those together and think in a sort of, from very apparently straightforward principles, you know, the two axioms, to some really quite strange ideas, is quite hard work. And in some ways, a quite mathematical way of approaching. And I think it is strange to look back and think those two axioms are both plausible, but you get you pop those into your head, step forward, and drop down a rabbit hole. And you think, you know, what way is up? It's very strange. So it is strange and discommoding, but I hope you have, there haven't been any missing steps along the way. We've sort of tiptoed through that whole landscape and got somewhere really quite exotic, step by step. So well done. Any questions before we move on? Okay. Then we shall, let's go back to here. There's a picture of competence scattering. Right. No. At this point, we somewhat change gears because we have to. Chapters 1 to 7 are about special relativity, as I've just said. Chapters 8 and 9 are about general relativity. Now, I've just finished saying, that the maths of special relativity is nice and simple. It's school maths. The same is not true for GR. The maths of GR is advanced undergraduate or graduate level maths. And if you carry on with doing astronomy masters or the theoretical physics course or a couple of other things, I think maths and astronomy, I'm not sure, there's a variety of courses, then you will have the opportunity to do the general relativity course in either your fourth or your fifth year. For you, it'll be in your fifth year if you do that. And I actually teach that course as well. But it's kept to there because it's the maths is challenging enough that you need a lot of practice to get up to that point. So we're not going to touch that maths here. But because of the way I've done special relativity, focusing on the geometry, it's not the only way you can introduce special relativity, but we're focused on the geometry. Because of that, I think, the point of that, the reason why I've done it that way, is because I think it makes a natural bridge into talking about GR. So we're not going to do many of the details of GR here, but because of the last 10 lectures, the last few weeks of relativity, we can go into a lot, the ideas, with a lot more sophistication than any sort of popular account. Okay? So pop accounts, we'll wave the hands about curved rubber sheets and all that stuff, and I'm sure you've seen those sort of things on television or whatever. We can do better than that. So, in a sense, the payoff, or one payoff of the last 10 lectures, is that we can have a quite sophisticated, if not very technical, although not hyper-technical, account of GR. So, enough rabbiting. One other thing. So there are very important aims to this. Appreciate, understand. And those are the point of all this. The objectives, however, are thin. Because it's not terribly easy to write exercises or homework or class tests or exams which cover this. So there are a limited number of things that I'm going to be able to say that are accessible. But I'm not going to let that stop me. So in in this part of the course, I will be saying things, a lot of things that aren't accessible because they're not on that list. So don't panic, right? I'm going to go fairly rapidly through this part. We're going to be jogging in these last five lectures, but don't get stressed because a lot of it isn't examinable, right? I'm telling you this because it's wonderful and beautiful and good for your intellectual and moral development, right? It makes you better people for having struggled with this, right? But don't get anxious, right? I feel it's important to say that, right? Because people do get anxious, right? But pay attention to the objectives. Those are the things that I think are fair. I think will be fair game. General relativity. As I said, the general in general relativity is not the special case of no acceleration, and not the special case of no gravity. Because although when we've been talking about special relativity, we've been talking about trains moving through stations. Trains are on the Earth. And they're held down by gravity and so on. But we've ignored the gravity bit. The gravity bit hasn't been important to what's happening. Things are going. All the trains are being moving along level train tracks. There'll be no gravity. We've just ignored it. Newton has a theory of gravity, which works very well. You can get to the moon and back with Newton's theory of gravity. Okay, so it's not wrong. It's just as we're about to discover. Doesn't quite get to tell the full story. But Newton, if something falls, if I have an apple, to pick an example at random, and I drop it, then as you know, the force of gravity acting on that apple is proportional to the mass of the Earth and proportional to the mass of the apple. That's G m1 m2 over r squared. So the bigger the apple, the heavier the apple, the more the force is in proportion to the mass. So there's a force. So the apple then accelerates toward the ground. How much does it accelerate? F equals ma. The apple accelerates in a proportion to, or inverse proportion to its mass. So if I double the mass of the apple, the force acting on it of gravity doubles, but the acceleration halves. So they just balance out. In other words, if I have an apple and a dirty great gold bar, or an apple and a feather in a vacuum, they will fall at the same rate because those things cancel out. And that's not surprising. You may well have seen videos of Apollo 16 or whatever it was, and whichever astronaut it was dropping a hammer and a feather on the surface of the moon. I believe they got in terrible trouble from mission control for doing that, because they weren't supposed to do that, and they smuggled it on board just because it was so much fun to do it on the moon. But this is strange. You think that's well, fairly obvious, right? But this is strange, because the two masses there are different things. The mass that is acted upon by gravity is a sort of gravitational charge. You can think of that as the gravitational mass of an object. It's how much is affected by gravity. The mass in the second equation is inertial mass. It's a different thing, really. That's the property that the apple has that lets it resist being accelerated. And there's no reason why they should have anything to do with each other. So you could imagine them being having quite different relationships to the dynamics. But it turns out, in Newton's mechanics and dynamics, they are exactly proportional. Not just proportional-ish, they are exactly proportional. So there seems to be no difference between these two, on the face of it, completely different things, inertial mass and gravitational mass. And that is strange, and Newton thought it was strange. He noticed it and said, I have no idea why that's true. In the general scholium, at the end of Pripyat, he basically says, I don't know why that's true. I don't know how gravity works, he said. So Newton did not claim to understand gravity. He said, I've got an equation which describes it, and if I start from the right place, all the math works out and all works. But I don't know what gravity is, he said. And that puzzle remained. But let's step aside from that for a moment and go out into space. And imagine you're in a box out in space, breathable, say. So you're well away from everything. You're in orbit or you're in between the stars or something. So there's no gravity, right? And everyone just floats around. And if there's a clock, there's photons, there's electromagnetism, there's biology happening, there's anything you like happening in that box. And everyone's just floating around. And the thing that is still true in that box is that Newton's three laws work. So if you push a clock across the cabin, it'll move at a constant speed until it hits the end. If you pull something, it'll accelerate according to F equals ma and so on. So Newton's laws work in that box exactly the way you'd expect. Of course, because why wouldn't they? Then, let's start a little rocket motor under the box. And you turn it on, and then the box would move, but we are floating around inside it, and nothing happens until the box reaches us and starts pushing us. So before the box touches us, we're not going to be affected by the box, obviously, right? But when the box does reach us, then we'll be pushed by the floor of the box. And if the rocket motor is set so that it produces an acceleration of 9.81 meters per second squared, then we are going to feel as if we're standing on Earth. We're going to be accelerated in exactly the same way. And that's exactly the same way. It's not ish. It is exactly the same way. We will not be able to tell the difference between being accelerated in that way and being on Earth, okay? And that is a physical statement. That's not a mathematical statement. That's a physical statement. That's true about our universe. that in our universe, we cannot tell the difference between a uniform gravitational field and an acceleration like that. And that's called the equivalence principle. And that explains the whole gravitational mass versus inertial mass thing. Because in the case where everyone's floating around, masses aren't involved. In the case where the rocket is pushing the cabin up towards us, everyone's going to inside the cabin is going to be accelerating toward the base of the cabin in exactly the same way, independent of their mass. So the statement that these two things are equivalent explains why the difference between gravitational and inertial mass doesn't matter. And this statement, the equivalence principle, was enunciated by Einstein. And it is what the general theory of relativity is based on. Variants of that principle is what the whole thing is. That's the starting point, if you like. Like the two axioms of special relativity, this equivalence principle is the starting point for the whole rest of the elaborate apparatus. Right, okay. And as I say, I'll say it again. It's a physical principle. It could be otherwise. It's not a mathematical necessity. It could be otherwise. Certainly, it was otherwise for Newton. Could be otherwise, but it is the case in our universe. Then let us, in the last moment, I will have to return to this afterwards. So uniform gravitational fields are equivalent to frames that accelerate uniformly relative to inertial frames. So that's the frame that's accelerating uniformly is this rocket frame. Another version of that, and this is the one that Einstein wrote down, all local free-falling non-rotating observatories are fully equivalent for the performance of all physical experiments. And all those words are important. The free-falling laboratory is the laboratory in the first picture, where the box is out in space. Einstein claimed this was the happiest. Einstein claimed that the happiest thought of his idea was what happens if you are in free fall, so just falling purely under gravity. If you jump out of a window. In a box, or if you're in a lift shaft and the lift cable breaks, bad situation. You're going to have a bad day, but on the way down, you can think, you can meditate on the delights of general relativity as you go, and that situation where you are falling freely under gravity, you and everyone inside the lift cabin and your dog if it's there or whatever, and a bowl of petunias are all going to be obeying Newton's laws perfectly. In the sense of accelerating here and there, so I'm garbling this. I will come back to that point. I will come back to the point and say why all the words of that are important and what they mean in context. I'll come back to that next time. I think there's next.